Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Most of the things that are grower, both farmer and rancher facing, run through the calendar year or through the crop year, and so that takes us through the end of the year. And so there's really nothing catastrophic that happens on September 30th.
Dr. Bart Fisher with Texas A&M on what happens if we don't get a new farm bill.
If you hear that Congress is not doing an extension, in October or November, it's not due to dysfunction. It's due to the fact that it doesn't really have to be done because nothing really bad starts happening. And even then, I think you've got some time in the new year as well. So they may choose to do one this fall, but it won't surprise me if they don't, in part because they just want to keep the focus on getting a new farm bill in place. And so I think that's probably where their attention will stay.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Milk production for the current calendar year, 2023, we pulled lower by about 400 million pounds.
Dr. Mark Chekanowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board with the latest from the September report.
That reflects two things, lower cow numbers and also lower milk per cow, reflecting the heat across the country over the past month, hot conditions reducing milk productivity, reducing milk per cow. We expect that to improve into 2024. So for 2024, that reduction only reflects lower cows in the first half, lower cow numbers in the first half of the year.
And for the rest of livestock?
So starting quickly with beef, as you can see, relatively small changes here on the production side. Beef production for the current year, 2023, reduced 40 million pounds, mainly reflecting slower marketings in the third quarter. Steer and heifer pace slowing down, offset to some degree, but not completely, by higher weights and higher cow slaughter. Pork production, also that is mainly reflecting just a slower pace and lighter weights for 2023. No changes for our 2024 outlook for either beef or pork. In terms of broilers, production there down as well for both years, current calendar year and next year, just reflecting slower, what we're seeing in the data, slower slaughter pace, hatchery data suggesting, smaller broiler crops and lower weights as well, combining to reduce broiler production in 2023, and we expect that to carry forward into 2024 as well. Prices, looks like we got those right last month, so didn't make any changes in terms of steers. Steer prices unchanged from last month. Hog prices, though, we did have to make an adjustment lower for the current calendar year, a fairly sharp reduction, reflecting lower wholesale prices, and especially the fact, as you know, that belly prices have collapsed over the past few weeks. So this is going to show up in lower hog prices as well. Didn't make any change for next year's hog price forecast at this point. Broilers and turkeys increased our broiler price forecast by a penny for the current crop year, just based on current prices. Turkey price forecast for both years, especially for the old year, there were some data revisions, some price revisions going back in the data, but we're also seeing relatively weak demand as well, pulling the prices down for both this year and next year. In terms of global U.S. meat trade, 2023 beef production, we pulled it down, mainly reflecting lower demand in Asia. Reduction in demand in Asia driving both the reduction in beef as well as pork for 2023, and we expect that to carry forward into 2024 as well. And for beef, also relatively high U.S. prices probably impacting some of that export demand as well. Broilers, exports down just on tight supplies, tightening supplies for both 2023 and 2024. Turkey's up just a little bit based on a bunch of countries, no real story there. And beef imports up, we raised for both 2023 and 2024, reflecting, tight supplies in the U.S., strong demand for beef, and some good availability in Oceania.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Consumer Price Index showed that inflation is still quite a bit stronger than maybe what the Federal Reserve would like, and that people are generally still paying more than they were a year ago for most things.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
This data doesn't necessarily take into account the sales volume, whereas another piece of data that came out last week was the advanced retail sales, and that's put out by the U.S. Census Bureau. And what that does is it actually totals the total number of sales, and it's more difficult to tell from that perspective whether it's an increase in foot traffic, as in people buying more items, or if it's just that things are more expensive. So the CPI really tells us that prices specifically are more expensive, where the sales report is trying to get at maybe a little bit more both that quantity and price type of thing. So when we look at the advanced retail sales, the unadjusted monthly data was about a 2.9% for all retail food and services. And that also breaks out into a few different categories. But I think one of the biggest things that struck me was food and drinking places. So that's characterized as restaurants and bars. And if you've walked around Manhattan lately or here in Denver, you know, you can be the judge of whether you think there's more people going out to eat or less. That category is up 9.1% over a year ago. And so I think it's probably a little bit of both, that you probably are seeing just generally check prices are higher because food is more expensive, but you still probably have some fairly robust foot traffic coming through there. The other thing I like to look at, and this isn't data that came out recently, this is still dated in July, the restaurant performance index gives us a little bit better idea of foot traffic. So that's one of the key indicators that they use in their survey. Again, this is July, but they've said since March that foot traffic has been down year over year. And so that also makes me believe that probably most of this increase in that sales data is really coming from how expensive things have gotten. But still, 9.1% over a year ago on eating and drinking places is an enormous increase.
So what can ag and producers in general pull from this?
It's difficult to maybe come away with a bite-sized soundbite here for what producers should take away, because it really tells you that the economy picture isn't very clear right now. There is some conflicting data in terms of, you know, the labor market does seem to be easing up a bit. But if the Federal Reserve continues to hike rates, what does that mean? Generally speaking, consumers are still being hit with inflation, but we really haven't seen a lot of cracks in the economy where it feels like the recession is here. I still am in the camp that I think we're going to have one, and that might mean some slowdown in those meat purchases. However, we really haven't seen any evidence of that. I mean, the beef market really has remained quite strong through lots of black swan events and shocks over the last couple of years. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens should we do have a recession. I think the retail level, there's probably room for retailers to squeeze their margins a little bit before you actually see an impact on the cattle, live cattle price, or even the boxed beef price. And packer margins are relatively weak compared to history. And so there's maybe not as many levers as they can pull as well. And so all of that plays into a fairly complicated situation right now for the cattle markets. But probably still the overarching theme for cattle producers is that cattle supplies are tight and prices probably continue to look better. That even with all of this stuff going on, these longer biological production systems still indicate that prices are very likely to be stable to higher for the next 2 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So there's about 14,000 transits each year, and I believe this year they've already hit that limit, and we still have a few months to go.
Dr. Sundarish Haragu is with Oklahoma State, talking about the Panama Canal.
This particular canal connects 1,920 ports in 170 countries with about 180 routes. And a lot of cargo from eastern U.S. to Asia, flows back and forth. Almost 60% of the cargo from Asia to eastern U.S. or the other way around goes through the canal. And a good part of it, Tony, is agricultural products, things like grains, oil seeds, soybean, corn, cotton, wine. So lots of things, right? So just from the U.S. alone, the exports that go, soybeans and corn exports are, about 25%, well, 26% for soybeans and 17% for corn. And on the import side, Chile and Peru ship fresh fruit, of course, wine. Almost 85% of Peru's fresh fruit exports are through the canal, as are Chile, half of Chile's exports. So a lot of material, agricultural products, manufactured products, things that are in process, raw materials, they flow through the canal.
We might not normally think of a lack of rainfall affecting transportation, but Dr. Haragu says
rainfall in Panama, which is one of the wettest countries in the world. So, for example, in Colon, is about 10 inches per month on average. But in its wettest month, which is November, it could be as high as 22 inches. The rainy season, we're actually in the middle of the rainy season, which runs from May through December. But what's happened now in the last few months, and it's projected to stay that way for the next few months, is that the water levels in Gatun Lake has dropped by 10%. So as a result, what the Panama Canal Authority is doing is asking vessels to reduce the weight so that the vessel draft, which is the distance between the water surface and the bottom of the ship, so that needs to go down. I guess they have a limit on what the vessel draft needs to be, and as a result, ship weights are reduced, the number of ships that they're able to push through the canal is reduced. Typically they also have other issues like maintenance and peak demand and fog and global events, but this is something that I don't believe they had expected even a few months ago. I mean, there's hot temperatures on either side of the Atlantic. El Nino is having its impact. So all of these factors are contributing to basically reduced shipping through the canal as a result. The number of vessels are having to wait. The number of vessels they are pushing through the canal used to be 36. Now it's 32. So that translates roughly into 1,400 fewer vessels per year, in a way defeating the purpose of the expansion, right? The reason they expanded was put the new locks was to be able to push through more ships. But Mother Nature is forcing them to reduce the number of vessels that they push through.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This legislation is designed to address an issue created by California's Advanced Clean Cars 2 regulations that seek to ban the sale of gas-powered vehicles in the next decade by requiring 35% of new vehicle sales to be electric vehicles in 2026 and fully 100% of sales to be electric vehicles by 2035.
Dr. John Joyce is a representative from Pennsylvania on legislation he's authored.
Because of the fact that 17 other states have adopted portions of California's Clean Air Act regulations, this decision could potentially impact over 40% of American auto market, and if enacted, would create a de facto ban on all gas-powered vehicles in the United States. As originally created, California's carve-out in the Clean Air Act of 1970 was designed to combat smog and pollution in and around Los Angeles, and it was never intended to be used as a tool to ban the vehicles that have transported Americans for over 100 years. Currently, the only thing standing in the way of California's implementation of this policy is a required EPA waiver. That's why I, along with Representative Latta, Bill Arrakis, and Obernolte, introduced H.R. 1435, the Preserving Choice in Vehicle Purchases Act. This bill would prevent the EPA administrator from granting a waiver to any regulation that would limit the sale or use of new vehicles with internal combustion engines. We cannot expect vehicle manufacturers to build one car in California and another one for Pennsylvania. In areas like my district in central and western Pennsylvania, electric vehicles are unable to perform in the mountainous terrain and lose range in high heat and in extreme cold. On a recent trip, Energy Secretary Granholm was unable to use a fleet of electric vehicles to travel across the state of Georgia without using a gas-powered vehicle to block a public charging station ahead of her arrival. Mr. Speaker, not every family will have an advanced staffer ready to reserve a charger for their vehicle. Even the Biden administrator's EPA administrator, Michael Regan, did not support the banning of internal combustion engines. In May, when I asked Administrator Regan if he supported such a ban during an Energy and Commerce Committee hearing, he responded, and I quote, "No, not at all." It's clear that more government interference cannot deliver innovation that Americans rely on.
New York Representative Nick Langworthy.
Not only is it costly, not only is it impractical, but our electric grids are not capable of handling this added burden. The latest reports by New York's own independent service operators show that New York State's electrical grid is strained in approaching a breaking point as Governor Hochul and Democrats in Albany ban everything connected to fossil fuels, from stoves to cars to natural gas hookups in buildings and private homes. It's very simple, folks. Banning gas vehicles forces New Yorkers and Californians, and one day all Americans, if we keep going down this path, to live in an energy future that is less affordable, less safe, and more dependent than ever on our most dangerous adversary, China. I strongly support this underlying legislation today and this rule as a step towards ensuring America does not follow the lead of the radical left in California, in New York. Let's put a stop to these nonsensical bans that only benefit our foreign adversaries while making life much harder for everyday Americans.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, if high very daily weighted average cattle for negotiated popped back up at the end of this week.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
We closed the week out, well, last week, I should say, at 185.12 for live FOB and 186.28 for live delivered. So those are price improvements from kind of the low to mid 170 or the mid to high 170s that we saw in the last couple of weeks.
And what is the futures contracts then looking like?
You know, the futures have been a little bit bumpy as well. They ended last week up about $1.50 in the nearby for 2023 contracts and up a little bit less, 1.3 across most of 2024. Now, one thing that was interesting is April 2024 right now is knocking on $200 per hundredweight. And so it'll be very exciting to see it break that. We're at what we closed Friday at 199.75. So very, very strong prices out there. Almost all the contracts in 2024 are now over 190. Quite a few of them are over 195.
Moving from cash cattle to boxed beef.
Boxed beef cutout has managed to hold the 300, or choice boxed beef cutout has managed to hold the 300 level. Last week we closed at 305.71. That is on the downward trend. We've sort of eased a little bit lower for several weeks now, coming off that high that we saw earlier this summer. And the question is, how low does that choice boxed beef get? I don't anticipate it falling a lot further. The kill levels have been a little bit smaller in recent weeks, and I think that'll be relatively supportive of that beef price.
And as we reach the end of the grilling season, will that affect demand?
We're certainly seeing it in what prices are doing relative to primals, and we should see that change over here relatively soon to focus more on middle meats as we enter that holiday season. Generally speaking, box beef outlook looks relatively supportive, and so does live cattle prices, but we talk a lot about consumer demand. There's no evidence that that's waning at this point. And so we're fairly optimistic that we can hold these levels and maybe even push a little bit higher into the fourth quarter.
So we turn from cattle to cotton. Mark Jekinowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board.
Greece, as you can see here, not a huge player in terms of a major global cotton producer. But if you've been watching the news, there's been a really remarkable meteorological event there that has impacted production. So this is a map of Greece showing you where most of the cotton is produced. Again, kind of the biggest production region is this area of Thessaly, counts for about 30% of Greece's production. And this is just a kind of a 82-hour radar loop of of the rain that fell in that area over the course of about 4 days. Just an astounding amount of rain that fell there. And for perspective, this is what it looks like in terms of those 4 day rainfall totals and the cumulative total. Cumulative total of over 14 inches, some localized reports of up to 2 feet of rain. So it's been extremely devastating for many areas there. Before and after, satellite photos, flooded fields. So this is a situation that's still, basically still unfolding. This just happened last week. We cut Greece's production by about 18%, again, focused mainly on this area of the country, accounting for most of that cut for over the course of the entire country. But it'll be a while before we know the full extent of the damage and what the final outcome would be. And it's also just important to know another reason to focus on Greece. Even though they're a relatively small producer, they export just about everything that they produce.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Soybean trade in Brazil and Argentina, the two largest soybean producers in South America.
Joanna Colucci with the University of Illinois discussing how drought is impacting South America.
The drought in Argentina had a significant impact on the flow of soybeans in 2023. Argentina became the unusual second leading destination for Brazilian soybeans in the first 7 months of the year, behind China. Brazilian soybean exports reached 72 million tons in the first 7 months of 2023, an increase of 20% compared to the same period last year. The increase was driven mainly by China, which bought almost 70% of Brazilian soybean exports in this period. From January to July, Brazil's soybean exports to China rose to a record of 50 million tons, a 25% increase from the same period in 2022. Behind the Chinese demand, Brazilian soybean exports have soared because of the severe drought affecting the soybean in the last crop season in Argentina. From January to July, Brazil sold more than 3 million tons of soybeans to Argentina, more than 15 times the total amount exported to Argentina during the same period last year. An extremely drought affected the entire soybean production area in Argentina this year. Production was just 46% of the average of the previous 5 harvests, declining to around 20 million tons. Therefore, Argentina's soybean meal exports between January and July have fallen by 33% compared to the same period last year. Most of Argentina's soybeans are processed and exported as meal and oil. The drought in Argentina had a significant impact on the flow of soybeans in South America. From January to July, Argentina imported 7 million tons in order to fulfill contracts already signed for soybean oil and meal, more than double the average in the last 5 years in the same period. So, soybean grain imports by Argentina from Brazil increased 16-fold, while soybean grain imports from Paraguay increased 33%. However, there were few soybean grains imports from Uruguay. Uruguay and Argentina were the South American nations most affected by the drought. Argentina has been among the leading exports of soybean meal and oil for more than 2 decades. However, the country is losing its top position as soybean meal export this season, giving up its place to Brazil, which has exported 20% more soybean meal than Argentina between January and July. In this period, Brazil exported 13 million tons of soybean meal and Argentina shipments total 10 million tons. China is likely to continue importing more soybeans from Brazil and possibly less from the United States as the price of American crops have been rising due to decreasing supply expectations, while Brazil's output prospects remain strong and attractive. Also, China tends to buy more soybeans from Brazil than the U.S. for geopolitical reasons.
You can learn more online, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Consumer Price Index for the month of August showed a significant uptick in the general inflation rate for all goods and services, but for food, a much better story, right?
Yeah, this month looked pretty calm on the food price updates.
Agriculture Department economist Matt McLaughlin says the all-item inflation rate during August was up almost 0.5%, but for food at the grocery store, prices only went up 0.1%. And Matt says, compared to a year ago at this time, the food inflation rate situation looks much better.
We still have a little ways to go until we're back to normal inflation rates, but we're getting pretty close.
In August of 2022, the yearly food price inflation rate was 13.5%. We're now down to only 3%. Now, pre-pandemic, what was the normal rate of yearly grocery store food price hikes?
About 2%. So we're starting to come back in line with historical norms.
And some items like eggs and milk are already selling for less than a year ago. Gary Crawford, Washington.